This is us learning in public, trying to...
Literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We're at Vancouver Public Library.
Yes.
There are glass doors. Yes. We're literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen. Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
There are times in our lives when we are able to make decisive choices about how we wish to be known. I was in high school when I came to accept that I would be Black forever after years of fighting internalized anti-Blackness and covert racism. And maybe that's not even true. Perhaps it was like undergrad. Maybe I was in like my early 20s when I was like, I'm Black. And I really accept this part of me.
Well, there's layers.
There's many.
There's
levels. Totally. And, you know, I've felt very aware of my Blackness. I felt emboldened to own it. I felt compelled to speak about it. And more than anything, I've become more comfortable in my own Black skin, which, you know, in this racist ass world is a major accomplishment, especially for a Black woman.
Absolutely.
When we launched the podcast in June of last year, so 2019, I was faced with another opportunity to like claim my identity, but this time in a really major way, or in a very public way, perhaps. Both of those things. So in this episode, I want to talk about queerness and my own current feelings about myself, what I've been struggling with, and how I'm trying to self-soothe and explore this like newer part of myself in ways that make me feel comfortable and grounded. And I'm hoping that what we get to talk about will be something that resonates with everybody that's listening. I think one of my biggest anxieties was like, what if I just like say shit that no one gets, or that
no
it's
one
just
else
me
has ever felt this way?
Because that's always the biggest fear, is that like, you're alone in your feelings and no one is ever going to understand you, and you're just, you know, unrelatable, you know. So I've been feeling very alone in my own little like bi girl world, you know. So I thought, let's bring it to the podcast.
Yes.
Why not? So before we get into anything more substantive, I want to check in with you. How are you feeling about talking about this topic? And what are you hoping to sort of glean or get from our conversation today?
I'm really excited to do this topic. I've been excited about this since you first said you might want to do an episode about this a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really excited to finally be doing it. And I'm just excited to connect with you on this and have maybe a more in-depth conversation. We've talked about this a bit, but I think to have a more in-depth conversation, I'm really excited about that.
Yeah.
And I happen to know that every queer woman that I know, which is a lot, has felt some of the ways that you felt and that we're going to talk about today. So I know that there's going to be a lot of resonance with it.
Yeah.
And I've felt these things too and felt really alone with them and had the sort of same worry that, oh, maybe this is just me and only I feel this way.
Yes.
So anyways, I'm just really excited to connect about this stuff.
Awesome.
Yay.
Yeah. And I think the reason that I wanted to talk about this, maybe I should just give some context of like what's going on in my life right now.
Yeah.
Because it's always helpful. Sometimes I feel like you know me, like you, Lala, know me.
Yes.
But then the people who are listening who, you know, are not my close personal friends or whatever. And not that I'm like need to be known in that way, but it's helpful in the context of this conversation. So recently I've become engaged. It's
Yay!
Been super exciting.
It's so exciting.
I'm super happy. Like, in case you can't hear me smiling.
Because big smile.
My face has been hurting for like a month now, just smiling so much.
Yeah.
Nolan and I, we've been together for like 5 years. He proposed January 3rd. Mm. It was lovely. I genuinely, like, what happened? Long story short, like, I picked the ring. I knew it was coming. And then he proposed and I literally was like, ah! And I like ran away. Like, I took the ring and ran away laughing. And people who know me will be like, that's so you.
Yes.
Like, and people who don't know me will be like, you sound like an asshole. But, you know, I ran away laughing. Nolan chased me laughing. It was great. It's been super awesome.
I love that.
Yeah, like, it's been so happy and there's been so much love sent to both of us. So that's been so exciting. But then at the same time, while I'm feeling all this joy, I also have sensed a bit of loss. Like, I've been feeling like, I don't know, this weird conflicting energy within inside of myself. And I'm thinking about the things I didn't get to do. And I think a lot of times people think, like, I didn't get to sleep with all the people I wanted to sleep with or something. Like, when they get married, you know, people, yeah, like, see it as, like, it's a death sentence. Like, it's a ball and chain or whatever. Like, I don't see it that way whatsoever. But I think after we were engaged, I kept on thinking, like, wow, we're engaged and I'm so happy. But at the same time, I'm also so aware of how I'm just beginning to understand and come to accept my queerness and identifying as bisexual.
Yeah.
And so there are parts of me that I haven't begun to really explore. And before we got engaged, I felt like I was avoiding even having that conversation with myself. Like, I had talked about it. And in the context of the podcast, claiming my identity in a really public way, it made me feel like I was, like, fucking up a good thing. I was like, wow, I felt like there was a bit of me that was being selfish. Like, here I am trying to own part of myself, but also, like, I have this amazing relationship. And, like, how does identifying like this potentially destabilize that or affect that, or, like, you know? And there was a part of me that felt like I was losing myself, and part of me that felt like, I don't know, I was like a cop out or something for, like, being in love with, like, a cishet white man kind of thing, and or, like, betraying my own politics in some ways because I identify as a Black, queer, like, bisexual woman. And all of those parts of my identity individually, but then collectively, when they're embodied by, like, me, are read a type of way by folks. And so, and I identify in a type of way that isn't your just kind of, like, mainstream white woman. I don't know how to describe that. So, you know, there was a part of me that felt like, why can't I just be happy without dealing with all of this mess? Like, why am I complicating my life? Right. You know? And then there was also, or there is also, a part of me that's like, yo, bisexual erasure is so real.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even when I came out in that public way, and I remember coming out to my mom, I was so covert and weird about it. I was like, hey, mommy, look, me and Lala are making a podcast. Look at the bio that we put on Instagram. I just, like, shoved my phone across, like, the countertop, and she read it. And she's like, that's really nice. So it's like, Nick is a Black queer woman. And so, like, we never had a conversation about it after that until later down the line, where I was experiencing some homophobia from my mom, and I felt like I needed to, like, nip it in the bud and be like, you're not going to say this shit about me. Like, I'm your daughter, I'm your kid. Like, you should be supporting me and stuff like that. So, yeah, like, this is really important to me and kind of close to my heart. And it's been hard for me to kind of come to terms with, one, talking to myself about it, two, talking to other people about it, and three, talking about it on a fucking podcast. So here we are.
Yes. How do you feel having just shared that?
It is liberating, but also, I don't know, we always talk about how there are some parts of our own life experiences that we obviously want to bring to the podcast and talk about and dissect and, like, pull into things that we are hoping to learn in public spaces. There's other parts of myself that I really want to keep secret or sacred or private, or that I don't feel like need to be shared necessarily with everybody. But it's so important to me because I think the podcast coming into my life and coming into both of our lives last year, and that being an opportunity to really introduce myself and really introduce myself to the world in a way that was, like, deliberate and new and claiming my identity and feeling in control of my narrative and my life, I feel like it's a good place to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I agree.
Yeah. I guess I'm curious how this makes you feel. Cause, like, you have been identifying as bi for how long?
About 10 years.
Yeah. So, like, is what I'm saying familiar? And I guess, like, what feelings does it bring up in you, or how does it make you feel or reflect on your own sort of journey?
It's very familiar. Mm. So it's very easy to connect with, and I have so much empathy and compassion, and always wanting to, without getting in the way of your process, it's like a desire to maybe save you from some of the heartache or some of the, like, self-judgment or, you know, wrestling with yourself that I know happens.
Mm-hmm.
And especially now, like, having been sort of in this process for longer. And I have a lot of friends who identify as bisexual women,
mm-hmm.
and who are partnered with men or have been partnered with men for significant parts of their lives. And so all of the things that you're talking about, I know so many people feel these things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just, like, so important to be talking about them out loud.
Yeah. And acknowledging that the things that you're feeling are real.
Yeah. Like validating each other and validating yourself. And also when we talk about shame and how what we need with shame is connection. Mm. I think this is a prime example because there's a lot of things that we're going to talk about today that it's really easy to sort of think, I feel this way because there's something wrong with me and I can't tell anybody because then they'll know. They'll mm-hmm. know that I'm a fraud or they'll know that, you know, that there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
And the fact is, I at this point know that all of these things are things that pretty much everybody feels. Yeah. And so it's just important to say it out loud so that you can have that experience of someone else being like, oh, yeah, me too. I felt that way. Yeah.
Yes. Totally. And you mentioning that other people are going to see you as a fraud or that fear that people will see you a type of way. We need to recognize the ways that others dictate our relationships to ourselves and our own gender identity and our own sexual orientation. Like the external things impact us internally. And so I've been reflecting and looking back at parts of my life to consider what I've learned or picked up in childhood and adolescenthood and now in my adult life. So in my childhood, I was super aware of how queerness was something to be like ashamed of or hide, and that it was, I felt really confused about it. And I learned that because there was so much silence on it. Like we never had conversations about it. And if we did, it was kind of in the context of thinking and talking about the Bible, because I grew up really Christian. And I knew that from those scriptures or from those teachings, if you take it literally in the translation, people have interpreted that as gay is not okay. Let's just say that, you know? And then in adolescenthood, I think I didn't feel comfortable exploring my sexuality at all or even questioning how I identified. I just kind of felt like I'm attracted to boys, or I like boys, or like I feel types of ways about boys. And then in my adulthood, it's been really like recognizing how fixated I have felt myself being on like the outside performance, like how people perceive and how I want to be known and that kind of thing. And it's always interesting when you talk to people who are out and look back at their experiences as a child or an adolescenthood or their young adult life. And they say things like, now that I know this about myself, that I identify as bi or queer or whatever it is, it explains so much about so many relationships that I had when I was this age or that age, or the way that I felt when I was around certain people. And I think for me, that's been the biggest piece of like resonating information. Yeah. So much of what has grounded me and made me grow and built me up has been my relationships with women and girls as a child and as an adult, and the love that I have for women and non-binary folks, because like I, you know, like I, the attraction that I have towards women, I know that now, but I didn't know that then. And I think kind of going back to this sense of loss and then feeling like, well, how come I didn't figure this out sooner? Like, why, what's wrong with me that I didn't know that before? And I know that there were so many reasons why I wouldn't have learned that about myself before that I just mentioned. But there's still
a sense of loss of like what could have been if I had grown up, you know, seeing queer people around me, like whether in, you know, my social groups, in my family, in the media, where I could have known that that was an option and lived in a culture where it truly was an option with that wasn't more like stigmatized than any other option. Mm-hmm. Right. That's a huge, huge loss.
Yeah. And not having representations of queerness.
Yeah.
Not having representations of Black queerness. Because we have to have these conversations in more than one context, right? It's not that I didn't ever see any representations of queerness. It's that I just didn't put two and two together that queerness and Blackness could go together and be embodied in one person. Yeah. And I guess I'm curious, for you growing up and you coming to identify as bi, did you ever have that? Or what were the things that kind of anchored you or made you feel, or didn't make you feel validated in your identity as queer?
I mean, growing up, I actually really didn't have representations of queerness that I can think of. I mean, I don't think that there were any out queer people in my whole hometown. If there were, I certainly didn't know about them. There weren't like any in my school. There weren't any adults in my life who were queer. I mean, there was sometimes very like malicious gossip about a few people.
Yeah.
In a way, you could say that's worse in some ways than no representation, because the only time you are exposed to this possibility, it's in a way of everybody being like whispering in an extremely negative way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there wasn't really, I mean, Ellen, I would have been like 10 when Ellen came out, and then Will and Grace, you know, became a show like a few years later.
Yeah.
So that, I guess, was on TV. But yeah, like white gay men, that has really nothing to do with me. So it wasn't helpful. So yeah, there was very, very little. I also think it's interesting because I think often the sort of dominating narrative of what it's like to be gay is the experience of gay men, and I'm sure largely white gay men. So the sort of I've known since I was three kind of thing, which is, I think, why a lot of queer women and bisexual women think we're not queer enough, because maybe we didn't know until we were much older.
Yes.
And I think part of that is, you know, especially if you're bisexual, if you do have attractions to the gender people expect you to, it's easy to just sort of stop there, to just sort of think, oh, okay, that must be it.
Yeah, it's like the path of least resistance. This works. Everyone thinks that this works for me. This works for me.
And it does. Yeah, yeah. It seems to in some ways.
Yeah.
So it can be easy to miss it that way. But I also just think women's sexuality is often different. We don't all, across genders and sexualities, and just as individual people, we don't all experience sexuality the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be a very common experience for gay men to know since they're three. And there are some people of all genders who have known since they were three.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also a lot of queer women who didn't know until they were in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Like, it's not uncommon at all.
How do you think that might be connected to the representations we see of, like, women's sexuality in general in media? Because for me, I kind of think, I think that there's a clear connection in that we don't really get to see, when I was growing up anyways, I never really understood or saw stories or narratives that centered on women experiencing pleasure.
Yeah.
When it came to sex or sexual or just sensuality or sexuality in general. And yeah, I guess I'm curious what you think
I
about
think
that.
Having a lot of shame around sexuality in general and growing up in a very sex negative environment.
Absolutely.
I think absolutely would have also made it a lot harder for me to know what who I was sexually, for sure. And then representations, I mean, as far as I know, like, the only show that's ever really centered on queer women and, like, multiple queer women is The L Word.
I was gonna say, yeah.
So The L Word didn't exist until I was in university. But even if it had, I mean, most characters on The L Word are still, like, thin white femmes people on, like, more on the femme side of the spectrum.
Yeah.
So even if it had been on, like, I feel like if it had been on and I'd seen it when I was younger, I would have known a little bit more. But even then, I don't know if I would.
Mm-hmm.
If we had, you know, well, now because we have Lena Waithe, there's, like, one person who's masculine of center who's known, and, you know, being a black woman, if she had been famous when I was a teenager, I feel like I probably would have figured it out sooner.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, it makes it so much harder when you're never shown the possibility. And like you said, like, not even realizing blackness and queerness can go together.
Yeah, if you it's had a wild seen, thing.
If you had had, like, a lot more black lesbians in your life, either through media or through just your social life.
Yeah.
Maybe that would have changed something for you.
I mean, I'm sure it would have changed things a whole lot, considering the fact that I grew up going to, like, Christian school and teaching vacation Bible school and just so deep in the church. Kind of similar situation as you, not growing up in a small town or anything like that, but in the
small kind of, like,
small circle, community. Small enough circle and community that, like, if people that we knew were, I don't know, not towing the, like, straight woman line, a straight young adult line, then there was a lot of whisperings and there was a lot of criticisms. And you also learn about how not to present yourself or how not to be out or whatever because of that fear that you see how other people who are identified in that way being treated.
Totally.
Right? seeing that, knowing how what that happened, and then going into the rest of my sort of young adult life and learning about things like intersectionality and learning about things like queer theory and learning and engaging with other people who were queer around me, I think it just made me go, wow, okay, this isn't the big bad wolf. Like, and then once you see that, you learn that, like, that's not the big bad wolf inside yourself. You know, there's nothing that you have to fear.
Yeah.
when you have that validation that these people are people around you that you can, like, love and that can be your friends and be part of your community, you can hopefully think the same of yourself. And we'll get into that in a second. But one of the questions that I actually wanted to ask you is, what does it mean to feel like you're not doing queerness right? And where do you think that comes from? Because so much of what I have been feeling like, especially if we're talking about this trajectory of, like, you don't have representations, you don't see yourself reflected, or you don't see anything that's even close to you, your identity being reflected, you know, that combination of brownness and queerness or blackness and queerness. Mm-hmm. And then you come out and you're kind of fumbling, you're like figuring it out, you hopefully have community around you that reflects love and acceptance, and you can start to accept yourself. But then there's still, like, you're telling me that you have met so many women of color, queer women of color, queer women, period, who have the same kind of experience. And so I guess my biggest question is, like, who's telling us how to be, like, the right type of queer? And where does that narrative even come from?
It honestly comes from everywhere. It comes from all sides. So, I mean, I think it doesn't help that in heterosexual culture.
The culture that is the pervasive culture. That, yeah.
The default is straight, right?
Yeah, of course.
So they assume you're straight from the second you're born. And they'll start putting that on you when you're a small child, you know, talking about, oh, that's not your boyfriend, or, you know, whatever.
Oh, God.
If you know, you're, oh, you look at her flirting with him, you know, if
it's like just like an infant.
Is like, yeah, exactly. Seriously, you could put, like, a baby in the arms of, like, a man, and the baby smiles like, oh, look at her flirting.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, it's really actually gross if you were to think,
like,
about it.
Yeah, we're sexualizing, but, like, children.
Yeah.
So weird.
But that's heterosexual culture, apparently.
Yeah.
And there is this idea of, if you think you're queer, well, are you really sure? Kind of, you have to prove it. Like, oh, well, have you really? Maybe you just haven't found the right man.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that already, that kind of pressure put on you from the power of the dominant culture.
Right.
That you have to prove it, and that it's probably not correct, and that
it's
you
a
just
phase.
Haven't. It's a phase. You haven't met the right man. You had a bad experience. You, whatever it is.
Deficit, 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 deficit.
Yes.
That's what proves that
you
are that thing.
Yeah. And that's, like, there's so much power behind that. Systemic power behind that.
Right.
And then from the queer community, I think, honestly, it can come from a lot of different places. I'm just going to speak to my personal experience.
Please do.
Because, yeah, a lot of different people who have different gender expressions than I do, or different sexualities, or just different experiences could talk about different places that it comes from. But from my experience as being femme presenting,
mm-hmm.
there is a sort of idea of, I think that you have to prove it more so than somebody who people zeroed in on that person from the time they were very young as different because of their gender expression.
Right.
You know, because that's the person who's, like, expected to be queer. And that has, of course, like, its own huge oppression in that.
Absolutely.
From my experience, it's just the, okay, well, you have to prove it. Are you really, though?
Yeah.
And so often it's in your relationship to other people, and in particular as a femme, your relationship to, like, masculine of center people that can kind of prove you to be queer enough. And then especially if you're bisexual, if you've been with men.
Mm-hmm.
There's also this idea in queer communities sometimes, you talked about bisexual erasure, very real. There's this thing that people like to call straight passing privilege.
Right. Yes, I've heard this.
And
how do you feel about that term?
It's very, very complicated.
Right.
It's very, very complicated to me, because there, in some ways, is a privilege that I can walk into a space and people don't assume that I'm queer, because I can be sort of more safe in some settings.
Yeah. More palatable to certain people.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And, like, even I'm less likely to be sort of accosted on the street, or, like, the victim of homophobic violence on the street.
Yeah.
Being a femme presenting woman of color, violence on the street happens to me for its own reasons.
Yes, exactly.
But not because I, by myself, am, like, pegged as being
queer.
Queer.
Yeah.
And I think also when you know, a cis woman is partnered with a cis man, there can be, again, similarly, there can be privileges that do go along with that.
Right.
Now, that said, where it gets complicated is if you look at the numbers, bisexual women are more likely to experience violence than either gay women or straight women.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And if being seen as straight sometimes protected you, then we should, you would think, have lower rates of violence than gay women.
Right.
And then you might think, well, bisexual women are more likely to be intimate with men, and men are more likely to commit violence. So maybe that's why they have higher rates of violence than gay women.
Okay.
But then why do we have higher rates of violence than straight women?
Yeah.
Who presumably are the most likely to have intimacy with men.
Right. So, like, what is the thing? Like, what's the common, what's the, and I don't know, maybe my hunch is that, is it that our sexuality is threatening to certain people? That, you
yeah.
know, like, I'm, I guess that's my question.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that it can be. And there are a lot of stereotypes of bisexual people as being
indecisive,
slutty,
promiscuous,
right?
Easy,
just loving
whatever,
sex, like,
totally.
You
yeah.
know, oh, they'll just do anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So consent doesn't matter if you're bisexual, maybe,
right.
to some people.
Right. I've never, yeah. Honestly,
our rates of
yes.
mental health also, we experience more mental health problems than either gay women
wow.
or straight women. So
wow.
that's why I think, I also think there's a maybe less access to protective factors at times.
Hmm.
Because community is protective. And when, as bisexuals, we're certainly not going to feel like we're accepted as all of who we are in straight communities.
Yeah.
But we also often feel like we're not accepted in queer communities.
Right.
Because people do that. They're like, oh, but are you really queer though? Oh, I know you've been with men, or like, look at you. Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we are not as accepted in queer communities. So I think that gives us a lack of access to a protective factor that could maybe help us in terms of like health outcomes and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's so complicated, where I would never want to take lightly the privileges that I do have of being able to blend in.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it's hard for me to, especially as a bisexual woman who has experienced a lot of violence
yeah.
and has experienced a lot of, you know, mental health things and that kind of thing. It's just pretty hard for me to see where the privilege is.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, totally. Where have you felt, because I felt this pressure or this internal feeling of like not being queer enough. And I'm wondering, it sounds like you have too.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much that is interlinked or tied in any way to also feeling not being Indian enough. Or for me, uh-huh. asking myself the question, not being Black enough. Because again, thinking about like, you're talking about communities and how we might not feel like we are necessarily accepted within like straight communities because we might be presenting as straight passing, let's say,
yeah.
but we're queer. And then we're in queer communities, we might still feel like, okay, well, I've been with men as a woman, so that like takes down some points from me being, my queerness points are like lower or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think about that in the context, queerness in the context of like racialized communities and what that might feel like. You know, for myself, it's only now in my like actual like my late 20s that I have, I'm turning 28 next week, let me say it, my late adult life.
You're
it's only my, I'm basically elderly and frail. But my hip is really fucked up. But anyways, it's only been in my, you know, my late 20s that I found other queer Black women, other
mm-hmm.
queer Black non-binary people to be part of my community.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so grateful for that right now. But I think about when you're talking about community that we don't have, for so many of us, it's such a big risk to step out into those spaces of those racialized spaces and say, actually, I'm not only am I, you know, part of this space because I'm Black, but I'm also part of this space because I'm also queer. Hopefully you accept me. And there's so much violence that happens within all communities, all of all races, but I think it can be really scary and damaging for a lot of us racialized folks, for Black folks, for Indigenous folks, for other folks of color who want that community in our cultural racial groups, but people in those groups internalize a lot of biphobia, transphobia, and homophobia that make it even more difficult for us to step out into our communities in like really authentic ways. So I guess I'm just curious, like, how much of that, you know, not feeling Indian enough and not feeling queer enough, like, where does that leave you? or have you felt that way?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny, I'm biracial and bisexual, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, can I be a part of a group? Like,
someone take me, claim me.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, I've absolutely felt both of those things. And I think the way that we talked about it in the last episode of like, they're always gonna find a way to get you, like, they're always right. gonna find something that makes you not enough, so that's, you have to like, you have to be able to own that for yourself.
Yes,
I think that really definitely applies here. But yeah, it can be really sad being a queer person of color, the ways that queer communities, and I mean, and in our, when we featured Alok Vaidmanon's work last week, mm-hmm. it really spoke to this. A lot of times you go to queer spaces and they're so overwhelmingly white.
Yes.
And it feels hostile to you in so many different ways.
Yeah.
And then it can be really, or it has been really sad for me at times where, you know, when I was younger and wasn't identifying as queer yet, and before I developed more of the queer consciousness, because the same way, I mean, being a person of color, if you're a person of color, you're a person of color. But you can also be a person of color and you can vote for Donald Trump and you can center white people in your personal and professional lives.
Yeah.
And the same way that's the case, being queer, you can be queer and...
And still toe the heteronormative lines.
Exactly.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
If you're queer, you're queer, you're queer. But you can toe the heteronormative lines. You can center cishet people in your lives. You can have shitty opinions. You can, you know...
Absolutely.
All of those things. And so I think... Before I realized I was queer, and even for a long time when I still had sort of straightness very centered in my life, it was easier for me to find, you know, feelings of belonging and camaraderie in communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now that I feel very, very, like,
deep
queer,
in your queerness, yes.
Yeah, and, like, can't just do that anymore, can't forget anymore, it feels very hostile. It just makes you realize, like, I mean, just so much of the world
is so hostile for us. Yeah,
exactly. It's so hard to find somebody who can hold all of who you are
Absolutely.
And not be hostile to like any part of you.
Abso-fucking-lutely. And I think,
or ignore us too.
Yes,
that's the other thing. Just a lot of people of color who would say that they're pro queer or whatever, but they just don't care about us.
No,
you know, like you can just see like they don't have the same energy for Janelle Monáe when she does Pink as they do when she does
like anything else.
Anything else.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or they just don't bother to, oh no, I, you know, didn't get around to listening to that or reading that or watching that. And it's like, okay.
You clearly don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
About like my identity or anything that's close
yeah.
to it. Yeah, absolutely. As we're thinking and talking about all these things, not feeling queer enough. And then my next question is, who are we performing queerness for? Because when we are waking up in the morning and we're stepping out of our homes, so much of what we do, and I can only speak for myself, I guess, so much of what I choose to do and how I present myself is to maintain my own safety and to make sure that I'm able to navigate space relatively unaffected by the fuckery,
mm-hmm.
Which makes a lot of sense. But I guess my question isn't to speak ill of the folks that have to consider how they navigate spaces that are harmful or oppressive. But I'm also really cognizant of the fact that when we're asking ourselves these questions of like, I'm not queer enough, or am I queer enough, or who gets to make the rules as to like what queerness presents, who are we centering? Like who is, you know, the arbiter of queerness? Mm-hmm.
Well, who do you think it is for you? Like, when you think about not feeling queer enough, like, who are you worried is going to feel that way and why?
I think other, like, Black queer women.
Yeah.
I think that's where it is. And I think the nature of my, like, my relationship, the fact that I'm also dating a cishet white man and I identify as a queer Black woman, I think in my mind, I guess I have judgments about myself, not about the person that I love, but I guess about, I sometimes I'm like, do I have integrity? Like, I question my own integrity. And it's almost as if I ought not to be in love with the person I'm in love with. I don't believe that, but there are parts of me that, like, have doubted whether or not I am consciously woke. Like, how woke are you? I think maybe it's the wokeness thing. Like, it's that feeling that you're never going to be as anti-oppressive as you really, quote unquote, should be. And then you end up cutting your legs from underneath you and saying, like, fuck it, I'm obviously doing this wrong. And that's maybe where it comes from. Honestly, I'm learning in public right now because I've probably never said that out loud. So it is, part of it is the self-judgment, and then part of it is the fear of other people being judgmental. And
it's so hard when, you know, of course queerness is political. It has to be, because we live in such a homophobic society. And it's not just political.
Yes. Thank you. Right? Thank
it's like you. We've been forced to be political of the world that we live in.
Yes. That's exactly what it is. In the same way that, you know, we always have conversations about how black hair is like seen as political. But then it also could just be how your hair naturally grows out of your body. The conditions and the climate in which black people have to live in to grow their hair out of their head as it is naturally and then move about the world makes it political.
So it's seen as a statement.
Yes.
If you wear a natural hairstyle.
Yes.
When it's just, the way that your hair grows.
Yes.
And I wonder if that becomes part of what happens for us, is that we expect ourselves and expect each other to be making political statements at every moment of our lives. Right? And so 100%. It's like everything about my life. And who I love, what's the political statement?
Yes, what does it mean? What message am I sending?
And it's not that we should never think about that, but at the same time, I think life and existence is a lot more than just politics.
Yes.
And I think that when people don't allow room for love and attraction and circumstance and coincidences and
serendipitousness, like the things that are magical in life.
I mean, because that's the thing. I mean, honestly, like, think about what it takes to fall in love with somebody.
Honestly,
like, you can have somebody who on paper is everything you want, and I have dated those people before sometimes, and I'm like, checking off all of my boxes of like everything that I
have ever wanted and
admire, it makes all the political statements that I want to make, and we just don't have sexual chemistry. Like, we just don't have that thing where like you sit down together and you're talking and you get into this vortex and you like just can't stop.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
And then sometimes it's somebody, you know, like you meet Nolan, who probably, like, if you read about him on paper, you wouldn't be like, this is my dream partner. And you meet him and you're just like, there's something about this person that just like I can't get enough
of. Lights my fucking fire.
Right?
Absolutely. And so at the end of the day, I love that you said that, like, some things are political, but not everything necessarily is. So
there's more than that.
It's complicated. Yeah. It's more complex than that. And I think at the end of the day, after we're questioning ourselves and our self-worth and we're feeling shitty and we're, like, feeling in self-isolation and we're just trying to, I don't know, ignore parts of ourselves and pretending we're feeling all these types of things, we're still left with us. With ourselves. We're still here. We always have to come back to ourselves. And I think that's what's made me realize that the answers aren't out there in the world. They're within myself. And so I kind of also now want to focus on things that can be supportive for us, because you're making me feel a lot of gratitude right now, thinking about the relationship that I have with Nolan and how sacred that relationship is and how tough we both fought for us to still to be together and to exist and to be in love and to choose each other every day. And so one of the things that I think has been super helpful for me is just talking to people in my life who love me no matter what, you know, talking with Nolan about this recently. I mentioned this to you a couple days ago, that we've had like some conversations about, you know, I was like, oh, we're recording this episode on queerness. And he was like, tell me about that. Because like after I proposed, I've been thinking about that for like, you know, the past month about how you're feeling. And he was basically like, I don't think that repression is ever healthy. So I want us to always commit ourselves to having these conversations. And maybe I need to ask you more questions, like, but tell me that I need to ask you more questions, or I need to be more inquisitive. But like, I just want us to always talk about these things. I want to always know where you're at. And if things change and what your needs are, because this man is fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. I will say that. Like, there's been no moment in my sort of journey into finding and understanding and accepting myself as bisexual and queer that I felt that he's been judgmental in any way. Mm-hmm. You know, last year, I remember we were in bed lying beside each other and he said to me, I don't see you any differently. Like, I don't love you less. I love you the exact same. And I just burst into tears. Like, I didn't even realize how much I was holding in about my fear of disappointing him or changing things or what, you know, all of those weird feelings that I was having. And then not only talking to him, but also talking to like, you, talking to other friends about how I'm feeling has been so fucking validating. And then remembering that we're worthy of love and being loved is a really important thing. Remembering that it's not a cop-out to be loved, that we don't need to punish ourselves by having a strict criteria for the bodies that we accept love from. Because I think that's part of it sometimes where we're like, no. Like, it's supposed to be like this. It's supposed to be like that. And it can be, but it also might not be like this or that. And it might just be what it is. And that can also be a really beautiful thing. Another part of myself is really trying to lean into being true to myself and allowing the joy and love that I've always wanted in my life to be the foundation of exploring every facet of my identity. Because I ask myself a lot of questions, as I always do with you and on this podcast. And like I said, I don't know the answer to this. And I think that's been the hardest part for me, is to not know what it all means and to accept myself without judgment and to not put a time stamp for figuring out myself. Like, there's a final exam and I need to cram and then I'm going to know the answer. Those are the things that I think have been super helpful so far. I'm curious how that resonates with you.
Yeah, those things all resonate. I think there needs to be, you need to have people who see all of you.
Yes.
And accept all of you. I think that's so important. You need to be able to express who you are in some way.
Yeah.
That's something for people to think about, you know, like what do you need? It can just be really helpful to make sure you go to your community, like go to queer events, mm-hmm. go and show up and, you know, go with your queer friends if you have them and just be around other queer people. Like, that can be a thing if you have access to that. Getting comfortable and exploring how you really feel and who you really are, that doesn't have to be qualified by anything that you do or anyone that you associate with or anything else, but is just like who you are.
Yes.
I think that's really important, to just be able to hold that space for yourself where you believe yourself.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I love it. Thank you. Okay, so now we're going to start wrapping up, but I want to do our BIPOC of the week. To be young, Anita Frika, a Jamaican-Canadian feminist, dub poet, and activist. Her work includes theatrical performances, 4 published collections of poetry, 12 plays, and 7 albums. Debi is the writer and performer in She Mami Wata and The Pussy Witch Hunt, which is a play that was airing at the Frank, at the Performance Works as part of Push Festival last week, which was, you know, end of January, beginning of February. And I got to go and watch this one woman show plus a good friend of mine who was part of the show. But to be in this performance takes on gender, sexuality, divinity, and eroticism, and the play is so specifically diasporic and queer and Black and feminine, and it was an absolute joy to watch. It was so awesome. I was so fucking happy, and I watched this with Danielle. It was great.
Amazing.
It was a good time. And so Debi played several different characters and moved from their childhood to their adulthood, weaving in a story of how friendships become fractured when there's this rejection to accept oneself and others in their own fullness. There's this character that she plays named Michael, and he's a church pastor who is obviously struggling with his sexuality, and that's illustrated by this very secretive relationship that he has with this drag queen. And Nikki is like another character that Debi plays, who is a queer dancer. She so clearly accepts and is comfortable in her sexuality, but only after removing herself from her home and her community for fear of being found out, thus the term like pussy witch hunt. She also is a dancer at, I think it's called the Pussy Witch, like sort of the dance club.
Amazing.
So it was really great. And the story takes place in Jamaica and integrates the reality of anti-gay buggery laws, which criminalize queerness. And I really love this play. It seemed to come at just the right time for me, you know? Mm. There's sometimes things that are just so serendipitous and you're like, I was meant to see this with my queer Black friend as well. Like, it was so special. But it was so special for me because the message that I took from it is that, you know, we are simultaneously grounded and tied to our communities, but we can also face a kind of harm that is experienced when the people around us are not able to confront facets of themselves, in this piece, queerness. So they act out in ways to police our sexuality, our identity, and our sense of self. And so much of how we look to accept ourselves is through how other people see us. So when other people don't accept us, well, we can't accept parts of ourselves, and we can struggle to give ourselves permission to accept who we are in our fullness. In the quest to find these answers to all these questions that I have, I've had to reckon with the fact that only I can decide what my queerness looks like, is expressed like, is felt like. And while I'm part of other communities, you know, my Black community, my family, other queer folks, I am part of myself and I belong to me. So I just want to say thank you to Bea for, first of all, just your incredible writing, work, and performance, and for bringing the narratives and experiences of Black diasporic queers to the stage. Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you.